All right, so Peter Hornfelt, mentor pilot, welcome to the Hear Us Out podcast. What I'd like to start with is hearing about what led you to create the mentor pilot persona and put out all the information that you have on various social media outlets.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
My pleasure. Yes.
So I started my social media adventure back in 2015, and at that time I was already quite established in my airline. I was a line training captain and a typewriting instructor, which means that I was instructing new pilots on flying the Boeing 737. And to be perfectly honest, my wife just thought that I needed a hobby. So it was her suggestion that, you have a lot of time on your hands, you like the sound of your own voice, so why don't you start a YouTube channel or something? And I had thought about it because I was really, really interested in what was happening in social media. I realized that it was probably going to have a very important impact on what was going to happen in the future. And I also found that there were very few social media outlets who portrayed my view of what my job was at the time, which, I was very, very happy with what I was doing. And at the time, if you went out on the internet and you looked at forums for like, what's it like to be a pilot out there, we would only find people who were venting, people who were frustrated and who were complaining about their jobs and about their unions and their employers and everything like that. And I realized that the happy pilots out there, they were probably out kite surfing or spending time with friends. They weren't spending their time on the internet. So I saw a bit of a niche that I didn't think was filled, which is someone who can explain the world of aviation in a positive but constructive and honest way. It's not all positive, obviously. There are negative aspects of it, but you have to at least give it, an honest review. And that's what I wanted to do. That's how I started it.
It's so interesting to me because your videos have a lot of graphics. They're really engaging. I watch a lot of them and find myself like, oh wow, it's been 22 minutes already, and look what I learned about this specific incident. And one actual thank you that I wanted to pass along to you was, I was one of those people who's always fascinated by flying, but would keep myself from doing things because I was hesitant to fly. And within your videos, there's a lot of really accessible information that helps somebody like me understand what is the body experiencing when you fly? What are the sounds that you're hearing? What is the when you feel like you're picking up acceleration or losing acceleration? What are these feelings? It's not the plane falling out of the sky. There's an explanation for it. And because your videos were so informative, now when I fly, first of all, it's much easier for me. And second, I can relate to, oh, that's what's happening right now. That's why when we just took off and we're 30 seconds in, the sound changed. That you've explained that in a way that somebody who doesn't have the technical expertise with flying can understand. And that was part of what attracted me to have this conversation is how accessible you make this information for the public. And it's a really good thing, and I'm appreciative of that.
Well, thank you. I mean, this was the whole point. When I the first, you know, for the first few videos that I did, which are unfortunately still up there,
That seems to
I
be a
was
common
kind
thread.
of aiming. No, it's always
Nobody likes the
cringe.
original
I just have to go
stuff.
back. I just have to go back 6 months to start feeling it cringe. But those were intended for people who are getting into the industry. But I very, very soon realized that there's a much bigger need, a much bigger interest out there from people who are not in the industry, but kind of needs to or wants to know more about it. And because I had the background in instructing, because I was dealing with new people coming into the flying the aircraft for the first time, I had already gotten used to explaining pretty complex matters, technical issues, in a way that would be easy to understand, because the only real way to learn something is to thoroughly understand it. I mean, you can teach someone to follow certain procedures and do certain steps in a certain way, but they will only remember it and be able to kind of build on it if they understand why they're doing, why they're taking those steps.
Yes.
So my aim from very early on in the channel's history was to make videos so that my mom would understand them. Right. That was that I'm trying to look at the camera in the beginning, especially when I wasn't working off scripts, looking in the camera, thinking, would my mom understand this? Who's an intelligent woman, but without any technical aviation background. Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't dumb things down, but I do explain them in a way that I think that someone without any previous knowledge would, if they listened carefully, still understand. And I think that's the key to never dumb down anything. Don't assume that people won't understand you. Keep the complexity. So if you've seen some of my videos, you'll notice that I don't shy away from going into very complex descriptions of hydraulic systems, mm-hmm. or technical systems in the aircraft, but you go through them step by step by explaining, like, if this pump breaks, that will stop the flow of fluid to this thing, which will then stop the flap from extending, which is exactly what happened now. You know?
Yes.
And I enjoy that. Like that's one of the most fun parts of it, of trying to kind of crack the nut on how to explain something that's really, really, really difficult in a way that, like, afterwards it makes complete sense to people.
I love that you answered my question before I even asked it, because I find that as audiologists, one of the big challenges is to convey very complex information to patients, and probably very putting a bomb on somebody in ways that they can understand and grasp and then move forward. And for you, I actually really like what you said about how treat it like you're telling your mom about it, of not dumbing it down, but being able to talk technical in ways that the layman can understand.
Oh, absolutely. And this takes time, right? That's one thing that you have to understand. Some feedback that I'm getting on my videos is like, dude, it's taking 30 minutes to tell something that I can tell you in 3 minutes. The aircraft, it came up, it flipped over and it crashed. Like, that's how long it will take. But no, if you want people to be able to fully understand what it is you're saying, you're going to have to take your time with it, mm-hmm. and really think through how you're going to explain something. So if you're talking about, you know, what's happening in the inner ear when you're losing your balance or something, well, you're going to have to give people some background information so they understand, okay, so how does those little hairs actually work inside of the ear?
Yeah.
And when you understand that, well, then you can take it one step further. And it's like, so in this case, there was a blockage here, which caused this to happen. And then, you know, step by step feeding. And what I try to do as well is that I front load my videos with a lot of the technical information. So, you know, you bring them into a video by telling them, like, okay, this is now going to happen. Something is going to happen on this flight, whatever it might be. Then you spend quite a lot of time giving these kind of like technical explanations of individual systems that you want to explain, which is in quotation marks, the boring part. But then once you have given them that, then you go into what actually happened on the flight. And all of a sudden people feel super intelligent because now they understand, right, he was talking about how those flaps were moving, and now they're not moving, and now it's causing that which he was talking about before. And you give them, hopefully the feeling should be that once they have left the video, they've thoroughly understood what happened. Mm-hmm. They don't really know why, but they understood what happened, and that will make you feel smart, and that will hopefully make you enjoy watching the video, even if I cover sometimes very, very horrible stuff.
And, you know, so you mentioned the ear and the inner ear and the hair cells. I'm curious, within your training as a pilot, if you're specifically trained in nervous system regulation to try and overcome when your body is that, hey, if a plane is bouncing around, your vestibular system is responding to that, whether you want it to or not, that because it's something that you need to function, you can't just close your eyes and put your head back in the chair when you get physically uncomfortable. Is there specific training to overcome that? How do pilots engage with those feelings that the body is experiencing?
So there's no specific training on, like, you know, like practical training on how to feel less sick. Uh-huh. But what you have is exposure. Right, you have training for us, theoretical training to understand why we're feeling that way and how we can avoid it, and then you have exposure for training, be handling the elements over a very long period of time. So there are people in my training group, for example, there were a few people, I think at least one, that stopped training because he just became too airsick. Uh-huh. And he was airsick over several sessions, and he couldn't concentrate on anything else. So he just, he was just too sensitive. His inner ear was just too sensitive. But then once you have been flying for a while, you notice the tricks. Like you concentrate on the horizon when it's a lot of turbulence out there. And when you concentrate on the horizon, the brain does not get fooled and you don't get the mismatch, which causes the nausea in the first place. First ever time that I was flying in a smaller aircraft, I did the mistake that everyone makes, which is you sit and you look straight down because obviously you want to see all the cool stuff that's below you. But that's literally the worst thing you can do because all of a sudden the brain has no references whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It just feels that it's bumping up and down, but there's nothing in the view that corresponds to that. So I got super airsick. And I mean, air sickness, for anyone out there who's listening, air sickness is car sickness times another dimension. Like it is, you feel sick for a day when you've had that. It just doesn't stop when you get out of the air and of the aircraft. It continues for hours. So that's one thing. But then obviously we have specific training around things like somatogravic illusion. Mm-hmm. Right? So because somatogravic illusion, which is where the inner ear cannot distinguish between an acceleration and a pitch change, that has caused several accidents because pilots react to what they feel is a severe pitch up of the aircraft, mm-hmm. when in reality it's a pitch down with a strong acceleration. So they then do the opposite of what you should do. They pitch forward even more, which then causes a further acceleration, which tricks the brain again to think that the aircraft is pitching up. This is one of the really, really big reasons why we have to focus on our instrumentation, mm-hmm. because we just cannot trust what our senses are telling us.
And as a passenger, I'm sure passengers can relate that there are times you don't know if the plane's going up or it's coming down, because within that inner ear, within the balance organs of the inner ear, that feeling is the same. So certainly makes sense all the time to need to focus on the instruments, because that's going to give you a clear, defined set of data that your brain is not. And the reason why the trick of looking at the horizon works is because the brain is integrating information to keep your balance from your ears, your eyes, and your body. And when your ears and your eyes are giving conflicting information, the brain is usually going to allow the eyes to override. So when you're sitting in a plane that's moving, but the horizon is stable, your brain focuses on the information from the eyes over the information from the ears. And that allows you to try and keep things a little bit more calm inside your body.
Yeah. This is fascinating stuff. And in fact, the somatogravic illusion part is what we use when we train pilots in simulators. So any pilot who's been doing their training, mm-hmm. they will sit inside of this giant box on the three legs that you can see, or the six legs actually. And they will, when you're sitting inside there and you start the takeoff roll, right? You will feel how the aircraft is accelerating. You'll be mm-hmm. pushed back in your seat. And if you look at that box outside, what happens is obviously that the box is tilting backwards, right? So inside of the box, we're seeing a straight horizon, a straight runway, mm-hmm. and we just feel how we are being pushed back into the seats. The brain interprets that as an acceleration, and that is carefully then obviously calculated to make sure that it shows the correct amount, so it doesn't fool or doesn't make us nauseous. But this is what we do. So we actually play with somatogravic illusion inside of our simulators all the time.
How do you ensure that you can hear your co-pilot, your crew? I'm sure there's a lot of surrounding noise and the audio must not work 100% of the time. What do you do to ensure that there's no slip up in terms of being able to hear the people around you?
So we use headsets. We use noise canceling headsets in the especially in the Boeing 737, because it's 70s technology. It's very noisy. So we, in the cockpit, me and my co-pilot always have noise cancelling headsets, and we have an intercom system, so we hear each other through our headsets, and that's the most, that's the best way. But then it, there's no question that you will have interference anyway, and sometimes it cuts out and things like that. So sticking to very specific phraseology and using callouts that we, that both, like if I'm supposed to make a call out, my colleague is expecting that call out to happen, is another kind of barrier, because it means that if the call out doesn't come, it can mean either of two things. Either there is something wrong, or there's something, like there's something wrong so that the call out didn't come for that reason, or the audio has cut out. In any of those cases, he will or she will check on me to see, okay, can you say that again? Or like 80 knots, confirm. So you make sure that those kind of mistakes caused by audio interruptions does not disrupt the actual work.
What's also interesting in saying that, by having specific callouts, it creates a closed set of what the potential auditory information that you're hearing could be. And the brain does something called auditory closure, where even if you don't hear absolutely everything that's said, the brain can fill in the pieces. So if there's less that it has to draw from to try and fill in those pieces, the more efficient the communication's going to be. So it makes sense that you're sticking to very specific bits of information, because that's going to be most easily and simply interpreted by the people that you're working with.
Yeah, and there's several dimensions to this. A, you have the fact that we are, you know, a lot of different cultures and a lot of different national backgrounds working together with a lot of different, sometimes speech patterns and things like that. So if we were to speak the way that we, you know, if I wanted to tell my co-pilot that I wanted him to please raise the landing gear, it's much more like he might expect something different, or he might expect it to sound in a different way. And it would just take a lot more time for me to explain it rather than just using gear up, which is a short, concise thing that both of us understands the meaning of.
Yes.
But then you have the other part is what you're saying, which is that if you hear something that sounds similar to what you're expecting, then you know, you're 95% sure that that was actually what was said. But then you add on a third layer, which is the confirmation, right? So we always work with closed loops. So the communicator will say a thing, and the receiver of that communication will then read back what they hear. And that will then, in a perfect world, be confirmed by the original communicator. So you always have a closed loop. And this is something we use with our traffic control, which is, I mean, in the cockpit is one thing, but at least we can turn towards each other and use a little bit of body language to convey what we try to see or say. But with our traffic control, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. We're dealing over really scrapey frequencies with a lot of different other aircraft calling and a lot of information being transmitted all the time. So there it's super important that we always have closed loop communication. So air traffic control will say, mentor 551, descend flight level 150. And I would read back, descending flight level 150, mentor 551. And that will, in some countries, even be responded with the call sign of the center, so London control or whatever, just to make sure that, yes, everyone has heard and everyone agrees.
And it's that gets the idea that we see with people with hearing loss of how oftentimes there's communication breakdown, that here in your line of work, you can never have a communication breakdown because it can be catastrophic, that there's all these checks in place to assure for efficient communication that's accurate. That I think there's something in that for people who are communicating with people with hearing loss to learn from, that there's responsibility in how you communicate to affect a conversation and to make sure that your message is not only communicated but received, because for you, it has to be received accurately.
Yeah. And this is something I actually do sometimes leadership courses where we talk about things like short-term decision-making, long-term decision-making, but also crucially communication. And I when I do those, it's normally to people within healthcare, for example, or within any type of industry. And I really press on the point that if if we would get used to actually reading back the instructions that we even in an environment of a office, for example, if we would get used to the, let's say the boss sends you a message like, I would like you to go and get me this file. If that could be responded with, okay, you just confirm you want me to go and get this file. No matter how nerdy that would sound and how weird it would sound in today's society, if people would get used to doing that, even via email, you would eliminate 90% of all of the misunderstandings and all of the subsequent problems that will come from it.
The extra 2 seconds it takes to say something.
So one of the themes that we've been examining in this podcast is becoming a part of people's stories. So as audiologists, as we help people hear and become part of their hearing journey, we can oftentimes be part of their story. We've spoken with musicians where their music becomes a soundtrack of people's lives. Have you had moments in your line of work, whether it's in the role as mentor pilot or in piloting, where you felt like you became a part of somebody's story in a way that was meaningful for you?
And there's so many different stories now. The more videos I put out, the more people kind of approach me out in the wild when they recognize me and tell their story, you know? I mean, it happened. I was in a watch store just 2 days ago, and someone came up to me and explained, like, "Oh, you're the reason that I went into to taking my private pilot license, and I just want to express, you know, my gratefulness for how you explain things and stuff." And that, of course, is hugely meaningful. Like, it really causes me to want to continue to do what I do. But even when you're flying as a pilot, you don't normally get into contact with the passengers as much as the cabin crew does, for example. But when things go wrong, that's when you really start to realize the job that you do, right? And this is also where you can kind of shine or not shine as a captain, because normally, if you just do your job right, like, you just get people from A to B safely and on time. But when things start to go wrong, that's when you can make a real difference in how you communicate with your passengers, for example, to make sure that they don't get anxiety or things like that.